everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Daniel Baker. Joining us today, we have Jennifer Waller. Jen was named president and CEO of the Colorado Bankers Association in January of 2022, after serving as president for 2 years. Jen joined CBA in 1999 as the senior vice president responsible for state government relations and banking advocacy. In 2016, she was promoted to chief operating officer, accountable for the daily operations and management of the association. Prior to joining CBA, Jen, the daughter of a community banker in rural southern Colorado, worked at her father's bank in Pueblo following high school graduation. Then, armed with some banking experience and knowledge of Colorado banking laws, she soon sat for the state bank examiner certification and spent 5 years as a bank examiner for the Colorado Division of Banking. Like so many leaders in the banking industry, Jen gives back to the community through her participation in numerous civic and educational programs. She's a trustee for the Graduate School of Banking, Colorado and Madison, a financial advisory council member for the Colorado University Leeds School of Business, and she serves on the boards of the Colorado Civil Justice League, Compliance Alliance, Common Sense Institute, Imagination Library, Society of State Bank Executives, and the Western States Director of Education Foundation. Jen enjoys politics and volunteering for campaigns, and she is passionate about lowering the number of unbanked and underbanked people in communities across Colorado, as well as advocating for more diversity and inclusion in the banking sector. Jen, welcome to the episode.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So Jen, I always like to ask, you know, we got a little bit of it in your bio, but how did you get started in the banking industry to begin with?
It really was in my blood. I mean, my father was a banker the whole time I was growing up. He was a small town banker. He had me and my two brothers sit in on board meetings, attend various banking functions, so we would be well prepared. One brother's a professor, another banker, another brother's also a banker.
Okay. So yeah, it's definitely in the DNA then.
It is, absolutely.
So were you primarily sent to, so something you don't know about me is I actually lived in Colorado for a few years. I lived in Springs and Fountain, and my wife is actually from southern Colorado, a little place called the San Luis Valley. I'm sure you've heard of it, going through Walsenburg and everything down there. So did you grow up in Pueblo? Is Pueblo home for you?
That's where I went to high school. I mean, okay. I was originally born in Texas. I'm still a Texas girl too. But yeah, I went to high school in Pueblo. We moved around a lot. I lived in Springfield, Colorado, and Buena Vista, Colorado, Hayden, Colorado. So always small towns.
Well, I love Colorado. Colorado is a beautiful place. It's definitely a gorgeous area. So the Bankers Association, are you based out of Denver area, Springs area? Where are you centralized?
We're in Denver. We're very close to the Capitol. Our office is about 4 blocks away.
Perfect. Makes great sense. I mean, you want to be nice and close there for everything.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we spend a lot of time there.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, especially during session and everything. I'm sure you get back and forth quite frequently. So then I have to ask, how did your background really prepare you for your current role? Because I mean, in your current role as president and CEO, you're overviewing a lot of responsibility in Colorado. What kind of experiences have you developed throughout your career that really led you to this position?
So it's kind of funny. My dad was also very political and always involved in campaigns. So I kind of get my love of politics and banking from my dad. Attended lots of functions, was a bank examiner, and then I took the job at CBA in 99 as a part-time job, thinking I would run for the legislature, and I needed to get some exposure. So I actually joined CBA thinking this will look great on a resume, and then I'll be gone, and I'm going to run for office or something, and I just fell in love with it. Very passionate about the industry. I always say, if you think of every positive in someone's life, like when they get to purchase a home or buy a car or put a kid through college, all those things we as bankers get to be a part of. Mm-hmm. So I'm very, very passionate. It's very, very exciting to me. And to be able to be a voice for that industry is really quite an honor. So I fell in love with it. I've been here 25 years now and will never leave.
Well, that's fantastic. And I love that concept of being very passionate about it because you're involved in so many parts of people's lives. Like I can't say I necessarily directly correlated with like weddings and school and all these different things. But you're right. I mean, that's exactly how this connects and how this works. So I do want to ask you one more question. In your bio, it mentions that you're really passionate about helping lowering the number of unbanked and underbanked people in communities across Colorado. How does that passion manifest itself? What do you do about that?
Well, I serve on the bank on, I used to serve, actually, I just had someone else take my place because I'm serving on too many boards now, but on Bank On Denver and Bank On Boulder. And now we have a kind of a statewide Bank On function through our attorney general's office. So CBA is engaged in that. In Colorado, and I don't think we're unique, there's a big challenge. We have a lot of immigrants who have a natural distrust of banks and a distrust of government. So banks telling them they need to open an account doesn't really help, and they may not have the right documentation. So it's really a focus on getting people what I call bankable, getting them ready and getting them comfortable with a banking system, because without a banking system or access to financial needs, they can never excel. Neither can their family.
So let's say then we have like a president of a small bank, one branch bank kind of thing listening in today. What piece of advice would you give them to help with these communities? How can they reach out to these communities? Is it just involved on a state level, or is there something that they can do?
I think more of a local level. I mean, the state level kind of coordinates, but nothing beats that local level. And getting involved with community service groups and helping be a voice for the industry through there and explaining how banking, I call it, you know, kind of banking for good, what we can do to help the community as a whole. But you build that trust by participating in those community groups.
I love it. I think that's great. So I know Colorado has kind of led the way in some unique elements of the law, especially when it comes to things like marijuana banking and cannabis and that whole field. Were you in, based on the years here, you were in CBA, you were involved in this process, Absolutely. Right? Would you mind telling me a little bit about the background behind how the Colorado Bankers Association handled this transition and this interesting time?
Yeah, so it was kind of crazy. So the voters passed medicinal marijuana in 2000. Then we passed recreational in 2012. It went into effect in 2014.
Right.
We were not supportive of the ballot measure. We were kind of agnostic. It's now Senator Hickenlooper was governor at the time. He was not supportive of it. A lot of concerns about the societal impact of legalization. Mm-hmm. But once it passed, we wanted the industry to be able to serve any legal business in our state, including marijuana. We had lots of banks just dive in, open tons of accounts, and then they were visited by regulators quickly and given usually 60 days to close those accounts.
Right.
And usually it wasn't in writing. Usually it was more of what I call a verbal threat. One banker that I know personally was told he would lose his FDIC insurance if he did not close all the accounts. Mm-hmm. We also had DEA agents come out and visit bankers and the bank commissioner. And the DEA agents explained that not only was it a violation of federal law, but the violation would pass down to the teller that accepted the funds.
Oh,
and so it really kind of put the fear of God in bankers, because basically DEA was explaining how they would look in orange. Basically,
congratulations, you can get handcuffed, dragged off, two coat over your head, the whole works.
Yeah, it was not a friendly conversation. So we had a few banks that really kind of pushed the envelope on that a little bit, and now we have quite a few banking it. But it was extreme. Like if you had a couple and one individual had a traditional job, another one worked at marijuana. Mm-hmm. You could not take into account that marijuana funds, the income base from a marijuana industry, to approve a mortgage or a car loan or anything. If you had a strip loan, a strip mall loan, where you had a marijuana tenant, originally regulators were calling that loan due. Mm-hmm. You had to either get the tenant evicted or call
pay
the loan.
The note. Interesting.
Right. Yeah, it was a little bit crazy. They relaxed quite a bit now.
Okay.
Often, like for strip malls, they're allowed to still have the tenant, but you can't base your repayment on that. Right. It has to float without that income.
So then how do you see law enforcement really getting involved nowadays? Or is it more of just like a, hey, look, the fad has passed and now like the industry has more established itself. What do you see on that side of things?
I haven't, DEA has stopped visiting us, so that's awesome that we don't have drop-bys, because that was intimidating as all get out. You don't really see much from law enforcement anymore. It's really relaxed now. And I think that's because so many states. So we were the first state to pass recreation.
You paved the path, right?
Yeah. So I think that everybody kind of calmed down a bit. And a lot of the fears we and others had about societal impacts didn't come to fruition, or didn't come to fruition at the rate we expected them to. The sky did not fall.
So then I know that there was that big initial moment, like everything's legal. Everybody's like, yeah, jump on board. And then they open all the accounts. You said the regulars came in and say, hey, you close these out now. And so they close out. And then everybody, I'm assuming, like, not everybody, but like banks started step by step, kind of gradually increasing the exposure to what they're doing and how they're handling these processes, because they have a better idea of what to do in this. So how did the legislatures handle all this? What did they do to address the lack of financial services for this industry?
So they tried to help, in air quotes, help, which a legislature trying to help you is always a really dangerous thing.
It's an interesting game. Yep.
Yep. So they created a kind of a marijuana bank in Colorado that would be a standalone entity. It was never created. Two institutions applied, but they had to have access to Fed. Otherwise, they were just a big vault and still a cash-only industry.
Yeah.
So that bill passed. We saw several attempts to create kind of a state-owned bank, but only for marijuana. So we saw one bill that passed was like private marijuana banks. They did not gain access to Fed, so nothing has happened with that. The other push we saw was to create a state-owned bank, but only to serve the marijuana industry. And we argued on both of those that it's a federal law that you're fighting. So if you don't have access to the Fed, and Federal Reserve cannot give an illegal entity access to the Fed window, this doesn't work, and you are a big vault, and you're still completely cash-based.
Right. So although they have multiple different branches or individuals banking with them, it still would equate to be a vault, because they wouldn't get the security or the FDIC insurance that a normal bank would.
Right. And without access to the payment system, you can write checks off of an account. You're still like, here's your cash. That's all you could do was transfer for cash, basically. So thank God that has eased up and changed a bit. We actually had marijuana industries paying their taxes, their state taxes, in cash. And they were taking cash down, to the Department of Revenue. In fact, the Department of Revenue had to train people to be tellers and had to put in vaults because they're not used to receiving cash.
That's interesting. I mean, you hear the clickbait stories about people paying their taxes in pennies and stuff like that. But I guess this makes sense that if they can't bank, they can't run transactions, that they're stuck in a cash only business. That makes a lot of sense to me.
What was fascinating for federal taxes, they had to go get postal money orders, which is hilarious that they could get a postal money order
with the funds
to pay tax on a federally illegal entity. And that's how they would pay their federal taxes, is by getting postal money orders, which again is crazy.
That's pretty interesting. I would never would have guessed like that. That's a whole new thing to me. So then as we were discussing kind of topics for today, you mentioned something called SAFER.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little bit of background to this. What is this, and then how is this going to impact Colorado banks?
So SAFER is the most recent version of the Federal Safe Banking Act that allows institutions to bank marijuana in states where it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
So in Colorado, it may not have that much impact, to be honest. We have 35 credit unions and banks that now serve the industry. And I'll get into a little bit about how they do that later. I don't know that everybody's going to want to serve the marijuana industry, because it's always going to be compliance heavy.
Right.
Just like not everybody serves adult entertainment, not everybody serves casinos, all of that. Yeah. So we may not have that many more banks jump in. What I like about it, I think it gives some protection to banks that are accidentally or unknowingly banking marijuana. And we have a lot of that going on. A lot of marijuana businesses would open accounts as a day spa or a bakery, or use all sorts of false names. And it takes a while for the bank to figure it out.
To identify it and everything. Yeah.
I think it gives them some protection. As far as I know, Colorado has more financial institutions serving the marijuana industry than any other state. That's why I say I'm not sure SAFER will impact Colorado that much. We're still lobbying for it. I still think it's a good law. Would love to get it across the finish line. I think this will be its eighth year or ninth year working on it in Congress.
Okay. So then you mentioned that you were going to get back to how banks and credit unions service the marijuana industry.
Yeah, it's crazy intense from a compliance perspective. So they do it with the knowledge, not quite approval, but knowledge of their federal regulator. They have to do in-person visits, usually quarterly, to the marijuana business. You have to account for every penny in that business and every penny leaving that business. So it's just very intense. And then you have to have a lot of specialization, and you have to have employees that recognize this is out of the bounds of normal for a marijuana business. Mm-hmm. We had a couple news stories where some Colombian individuals who are rather iffy were involved in the marijuana business, and that's not legal, and a bank was serving them. So there were some problems there. So it takes a lot of expertise, and it's very expensive, and banks charge for that expertise. So it's very expensive for the marijuana-related business also.
So then if you had a bank that was looking at getting involved in this, how would they go about it? Or is it more one of those things like, hey, look, like it's best to kind of avoid this if you don't have experience in it? What would you suggest around those?
So, and we never weigh in on whether a bank should or should not bank it. If a bank is considering the first thing you need to do is talk to your board, and you need to make sure your board is willing to accept that additional risk, because it's still a federally illegal activity.
Right.
So if someone chose to enforce the federal law, you would have to get rid of those deposits. Mm-hmm. And I say deposits because we're not seeing many banks lend. We're starting to see banks lend like on a strip mall that may have a tenant, but you don't see broad lending to the marijuana industry right now. Then you need to inform your regulators that you're planning on doing it. And some banks have been told no. The regulator just isn't comfortable with a bank taking on that risk profile. And then you have to have the expense of training your staff and determining what amount you're going to allow, because you don't want a concentration. I've heard regulators are watching for that. They don't want a concentration of marijuana funds in the bank in case those funds have to leave the bank.
Yeah, so. In case they're given the time frame where they say, hey, like get rid of the accounts, and then that's that.
Right. You don't want the bank depending on it from a liquidity perspective.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for letting me pick your brain about the whole marijuana side of the industry. That's not something that I've had the chance to spend any real time in and everything. So it's really interesting to hear it from your perspective.
The one other fun fact I would throw out, I should say fun fact that I throw out, my friend Lori from Arkansas always does fun facts. Colorado made $322 million in taxes from marijuana last year. That's 2022 numbers. So it is serious business in Colorado.
Okay. That is a very interesting number to hear.
Yeah. So I wanted to include that. It's not a small business. It's real money. It's real business in the state.
Well, I mean, it makes sense why so many banks or a chunk of banks have looked at it, getting into it, because obviously, somewhere along the road, they're determining that it's worth the effort for them to get those deposits and everything like that. So that's very interesting to hear those numbers. So then I did want to give you an opportunity before we wrap up and kind of end the podcast. If you could give one piece of advice to our listeners today, and it doesn't have to be about marijuana or anything like that, it can just be from your background, what piece of advice would you give our listeners?
Well, I'm going to be selfish with this one, and I would encourage banks to follow their banking association closely regarding legislative matters, because what public officials are doing is impacting the industry. We need more bankers engaged to help promote the economy and the banking industry as whole. So that's a selfish plug for SBAs, but that would be my advice. I'm surprised from time to time how bankers often don't know the bills that are either defeated or in the works that banking associations are working on.
So I will say that amongst all the people that I have interviewed, that's a fairly common trend is get involved, know what the laws that are coming up, know how they're going to affect you and get involved in the process. Because it's only by getting involved in the process, no matter which side you're on, whether you're for or against something, it's only by getting involved in the process that you can impact something or make a difference. Otherwise, you're just sitting there on your hands and twiddling your thumbs.
Very true. Very true.
Well, Jen, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me and taking time out of your busy schedule. Thank you very much.
Happy to. It was great to visit with you.
For the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.